Session number 6229, Reel 11.
This is Carly, Reel 11. Were there any tangible reasons that you can put your finger on for having those kinds of apprehensions?
Were there any reasons?
These fears about possibility of Japanese purges, where did they spring from? What was the source?
Well, I think that because of their original treatment, when they first took the prison, especially, you know, the way they treated the Australian nurses and what had happened to them, and the original treatment that those people who were shipwrecked had received, I think, made us realise at the back of our minds that there was always that streak in them, and there was always that reaction. After all, they need not have behaved as they did on that occasion. So it was, after all, those people were in their hands and they couldn't do anything, and yet they treated them in that way. And I suppose probably that was the thing at the back of our minds. We knew that they could, that they were capable of that sort of thing.
Between the Japanese announcement of the end of the war and the actual appearance of a liberating force, how much time elapsed, and what was that period like?
Well, of course, the great thing was that they threw open the camp to the men. The men, we didn't even know the men had been transferred with us. The men had been in Muntok somewhere, which we hadn't had any contact with them in Muntok. We didn't know that they too had been transferred and were not very far away in a camp at Lubuk Lingel. And once they had told us it was peace, they did advise us that he did say, you are advised to stay in the camps until the English or the Dutch come for you. They will come for you, but you're advised to stay where you are, and we will look after you until you are released. But they did throw open the camp to the men. And so the men came streaming in. And that, of course, was a great help to us, because despite the fact that they too had been in harsh conditions, they seemed to be in a far stronger state than we were. And they immediately took on all the heavy chores. And they went into the cookhouse to do the cooking. They chopped the wood. And I said in my diary, watching a man chop wood, three strokes and there's the wood in pieces. When I think of the way we struggled, you know, and it was like that. And they wouldn't let us carry the water. And so I thought, oh, thank goodness I hadn't got any more water carrying to do. And they were just in and out of the camp. Of course, a lot of them were the husbands of the women in the camp. And I forgot to say that before Siki, that was the commandant, had told us that the war was over, you asked for any signs. And one of the things they did was to call together the children who they said were going to be allowed to visit their fathers. And of course, this had never been done before. And they said that all the children who'd got fathers in the men's camp, of course, not all of the children had fathers in the men's camp, but those who had fathers in the men's camp could go and visit them. So we dollied these children up, and, because their fathers hadn't seen them for 3.5 years, and so we made sure all the children, you know, had clean dresses, and we tidied them up and did them up as best we could so that their fathers would see them at their best. And then as they went out, their names were taken and some of them were turned back. And we discovered afterwards that was because the men had died. And they'd never told us. They'd never told the wives that the husbands had died. In fact, the first thing one woman knew was she'd got a suitcase sent in and a pair of her husband's boots came in. No message, just his suitcase and a pair of boots. And she knew from that he'd died. You know, and some of them had been dead a year and they'd never told us, never told the women. And the first that a lot of the women knew was when the children were not allowed to go because there were no fathers to go to. And that was, of course, that was in between. That was before he told us that the war was over. So that was one thing that, of course, was so extraordinary that we wondered what was going on. However, the time then, when the men came in, and as I say, they did all the heavy chores for us, which was a great thing, and we just sat and waited. Another thing they did was to go into the town. We were told, we were warned not to attempt to go into the town, because we didn't realise it, of course, but we found out afterwards that a lot of the Indonesians were getting up a political movement against the Europeans, and they had no intention anymore of being under European rule. And so there was quite a strong political faction, and they knew that it was not safe for anybody to go into the town because the Indonesians couldn't be trusted. But a lot of the men went down, and they opened up the godowns, which were the sheds, and brought in as much as they could find. And, of course, much to our chagrin, there was food in the store, Red Cross parcels galore, stored in these godowns that we'd never had. And all this was brought into the camp, things that, you know, might have meant life to some of those people who died. There it was in the godowns, and they'd never brought it into us. There was butter and tinned meat and of course, most of all, medicines. And immediately they opened this up. I was given a course of malarial tablets, and of course my fevers then dropped. I was given a handful of tablets. I know I exclaimed, because sometimes I got as much as a half a tablet, which of course was neither here nor there. And sometimes they had one tablet for 100 people. But then they brought in, they'd got masses of medical supplies, all hoarded up. Of course, a lot of the medical supplies came in the Red Cross parcels. Obviously, I mean, this is the sort of thing people were sending by Red Cross parcels. And so this was all brought in, which was great help, and all sorts of things. And among the things they brought in, it was rather amusing, of course, they brought in a lot of Jap uniforms, the boots, those funny boots that they wear, and also leather boots, because I know one of the girls got those, and they issued these round. And of course, the Japs are got smaller feet than most of the British people, and so a lot of the women were only too pleased to take on these boots, because they hadn't any shoes. We were walking round in these trompers, which were like wooden sandals, and some of them with bare feet, no shoes at all, and of course they were glad of the shorts and everything. So we were running around half dressed in Jap khaki, and the men of course clothed themselves in the Japanese khaki. And there was all sorts of stuff, and there was so much clothing and things that we were able to flog this in the end through the wire to the Indonesians, who were very short of clothes. They grabbed at all this khaki stuff and gave us food in exchange. So we were getting chickens and all sorts of things. Eggs and chickens were coming in. It was like a birthday every day. But of course, really and truly, I said, you know, I couldn't enjoy it. It was too much all at once. There was so much food coming in that we hadn't had, and we were in no state to suddenly change our diet so drastically. And so a lot of people were more upset with eating the food than they would have been steadily, you know, having a little at a time. But it seemed that everything came at once. Things that we hadn't seen for years were coming. And so that went on until it eventually, I think it was about a fortnight later, that Major Jacobs and his party arrived. And he was a South African who had been sent from Colombo, where he was part of an intelligence headquarters from Colombo. And he was sent with a very small party of just four other men to do all the releasing and finding out exactly what was happening in Sumatra and how best to deal with the prisoners they knew were there. And, of course, it's incredible when you read his story that he could possibly have taken on such a job, because there was just five of them parachuted in, and there were 8,000 Japs, and there were just these five who'd got to go round, make themselves known, find out the position, find out if the Japs were going to surrender without any difficulty, and locate the prisoners and decide on the best way of getting them repatriated. So it was an absolutely formidable task. I just can't, you know, myself, even though I've read his book, of course we didn't know at the time, I've only found out since, but reading his book and finding out, you know, what they did, it's unbelievable almost, but they did. And there was he, two Australians in his party, one Chinese and a Dutchman. So that was just about right, because the Chinese was able, he was able to speak several languages, and he had a smattering of Japanese, knew Indonesian, Chinese and so on, so he was useful. The Dutch, of course, the Dutchman could speak Dutch, which of course, and probably Indonesian, because he'd been there. And then there was the Australians and the English. I don't think they'd got languages, but they were experts in radio communication, which of course they needed. They were doing everything by radio communication. And they gradually tracked down the camps. They got the Japs, of course, insisted that the Japs help them to go around the various camps. And eventually they had a feeling that the Japs weren't telling them about something. They didn't know, but there were various sort of odd rumours that there was still another camp they hadn't been to. And they couldn't find out. The Japs said no, they'd been to them all, there weren't any more, and so on. And why? I don't know. Why they were keeping our location secret? Goodness knows. I don't know. Can't imagine what they had, what reason was. But anyway, they were. They were not forthcoming at all about our location. But through sheer chance, Major Jacobs discovered that somewhere or other there were some Australian nursing sisters, and he hadn't come across any in any of the camps. And yet he had proof that somewhere there should have been Australian nursing sisters. And he was told at one point, yes, but they'd all died. But he still wasn't very happy about this. And eventually he did discover our location. And so when he came, of course, one of the first words he said was that ours was the last camp. And we roared with laughter, which I think must have astonished him, because we'd always said, I bet we'll be the last. It was so funny. We'd always said that. I bet we'll be the last to go. And that was the first thing he said. Well, I'm sorry we've been so long, but yours is the last camp.
Having arrived, what sort of arrangements did he begin to make for your repatriation?
Well, of course, numbers were the first thing, and nationalities, and where we'd got to go, where we were headed for. And then the only thing they could do was, of course, to clear an airstrip. This was most important. They wanted to fly us out, and to do that, they had to get an airstrip ready, and so that planes could come and take us out, because shipping wasn't safe. It was all mined. All the channels were mined, and there was no chance of shipping. So the only way to get us out, it was a rather a slow process, by plane, of course. And so they took, of course, first the sick, which was the best thing, and gradually they got us all out and took us to Singapore. And then, of course, Singapore was all ready for receiving us, and we were put into hotels and just looked after until they could ship us home from there.
Who were you looked after by in Singapore?
Well, it seemed that the military, there seemed to be a command by that time of British military. Because, of course, Singapore had known immediately that the war was over. So to all intents and purposes, by the time we got there, they had a month to organise things again, because they'd found out immediately the war was over and started to organise immediately. Whether they'd flown in personnel to deal with it, I don't know. I should think they probably had.
Now, looking back over that that period of internment, what was its biggest impact on you personally?
Well, it seems strange, but I think for the first time in my life, I had become an independent person in my own right. Being the youngest in a family with older sisters, when I was young, I was always told what to do, more or less. I wasn't very independent. And I married fairly soon after I started teaching. And in the army, one isn't exactly independent. You do what the army tells you. And then I married quite young. My husband was several years older than I was. I automatically took it for granted that he made the decisions and so on. And I was quite content to go along like that. But, of course, it was quite different. In turn, I had to be myself. And I did find that I perhaps was a bit of a different person from what I'd always thought I was. I found my independence. I found that I, in a tight spot, I had enough there to depend on myself. Something I think I would have doubted if anyone had told me that I'd got to do this and face this. I should have said, oh, I could never do that. I'd never survive. But you see, I found I did have the strength. I did have the will. I did have it somewhere there that I could be myself and survive. That was one very great thing. I also found that personal possessions meant nothing, that nothing really matters. What do possessions mean? I'd always been rather fond of things, and I remember crying when a wedding present got broken, the thing, which makes me laugh now, something I could never do. I can break things and lose things, and it never bothers me now. I mean, that just doesn't matter. Possessions don't matter, you know. I can shrug my shoulders and think, well, what does it matter? And
did the opposite happen? In the way that things which had previously been important to you now became unimportant?
Yes.
Did things which had previously been unimportant become important?
But I can't think what was unimportant that I could say that became important.
But values changed, huh?
But I think that I certainly found that a lot of things in my life I had considered previously important, I knew really were not at all important. I thought personal relationships were very important, and I had also come away with an extremely high regard for members of my own sex, which I didn't have before. I used to rather shy away from women's company. I wasn't awfully fond of women's company. I was much more at home in men's company, and I really, found women boring and vapid, and I don't know, I just never seemed to meet the right women, I suppose. The women I knew were just wives who thought nothing about anything except their children and their servants and playing mahjong and gossip, which had never been my idea because I'd always taught and worked, and I felt I just wasn't interested. I never found anything interesting about them. And so I always preferred older people's company and men's company. But when I came out of camp, I had a very healthy respect and regard for women, which I have retained for the rest of my life. I know that women are dependable and women are strong, extremely strong in a crisis. And I really, I'm not a woman's libber, but I do admire women very much, and I know how very reliable they can be and how very strong. And I think, what else? I don't know, as I say, I live for the day. Mm. I never bother about the future now.
What about religious or philosophical aspects? Did your position, your beliefs change?
It's very odd. I never, religion, I lost what religion I had early in life and became very doubtful. I came of a very religious household, and I soon began to question. And so I really hadn't any faith at all. And when I was in the camp, of course, I was thrust in among the missionaries and so on, and we had these religious services. It still had made no impact upon me at all. And it's very strange because I think with a lot of people, they found a faith in camp, and I lost any connection with it that I could have because I couldn't possibly, I hope this isn't, I don't like saying this because I don't like possibility of influencing anybody else, but I'm sure you're too strong-minded. If you've got your own opinions, my opinions won't affect you. But I can't picture a God who could possibly have allowed to happen what did happen. And there were these people who were praying to him daily, twice a day, living as good a life as they possibly could. They had every reason. They were his children, if anybody was. And yet they got no better treatment than I did. And I felt really less and less that there could be possibly anybody there who cared about anybody here. I thought the only people I found, the only person I knew about was myself, and I had to rely upon me. And I think if it comes to the end, everybody has to live their own lives, be themselves, do what they can, live by their own code of conduct, whether it's fundamentally, I think basically my code of conduct has a religious basis because I was brought up that way. And so, I mean, it means a lot to me to be truthful and honest and, you know, do unto others as I would be done by that. Yes, yes, that's my faith, that's my religion, to live to the best of my ability, my way. But I really can't think that there's anybody there, and I felt less and less that there was anybody there all through camp. If they could believe it. Mind you, I never ever voiced this opinion in camp because I wouldn't for the world. I don't like letting anybody know how I feel because I find that it could force other people to doubt. But and I would hate that.
What about your attitude to the Japanese? How in the long term was that affected by your experiences at their hands?
Well, nothing at all. People say now, you know, I bet you. You hate the Japs and you could do this. And I have no feeling. I feel the same now as we began to feel in camp, totally ignoring the fact of their existence. And I can do that now. I mean, if I met a Jap over here at classes or in a shop, it would mean nothing to me at all. For one thing, I'm sensible enough to know that the present-day Japanese are not responsible for what happened to us 40 years ago. And to visit the sins of the fathers upon the children is another one of my tenets that I don't believe in. I don't think that any children can be responsible for what their parents did unto the third and fourth generation. No fear. The people who did it were responsible, and the people who did it were punished, or the people who did it have died. You couldn't go on thinking that about the present-day generation. And
yes. Is this sort of reaction, do you think, a kind of, if you like, a necessary defence mechanism for yourself?
It may be, because I think, you see, you can't go through life being bitter because it would affect the whole of your existence. You can't be bitter in one part of your life and not bitter in another. So bitterness is a thing that sort of eats into your whole life. And so if you let it get a hold of you, it could flavour the whole of your existence, which would make life a misery. My one aim was to forget it, put it behind me, and forget it, which I have, I think, successfully, because ever since I've been home, I have never, ever dreamt about it. Now, I dream about all sorts of things that I wish I didn't dream about, but I've never, ever dreamt about internment, which I think says a lot for my, absolute intention of putting it behind me.
It was interesting. I was talking to another woman, a Dutch woman, who was interned, and she was telling me how bitter her husband had been for so long after the war about that whole episode. And she made the comment that, unlike herself, he wasn't able to digest that experience. Does that strike any sort of chord with you?
Yes, I think so, because as you've mentioned the men, which I didn't intend to, but I can tell. I belong to the Far East Prisoners of War Association. I've only joined recently, and so they send me a magazine. And I can tell from the articles that the men who write it are still wallowing in it. It still so fresh in their minds. It's still something they talk about. They gather together and have these reunions, and they talk about it. They write in this magazine about it, and you can tell from the very way they express things about the Japs, the things that they say about them, that it's still there. And for some reason, it's eaten into their souls much deeper than it did into ours. I can understand it in a way. They're men. It was ignominious for them to be taken prisoners. It was the sheer ignominy of it, I think, that was absolutely traumatic for them. I think it's a different masculine outlook. But I still feel that a lot of them are allowing it to overshadow their lives. And I mean, I haven't heard it recently, because after all, this is a long time ago. But I mean, I did realise that for years after the war, you'd have criminals in a dock putting forward the fact that they were, oh well, they were prisoners of war, and it's affected their whole lives. And you know, to me, that was absolutely a bit of utter nonsense. I think they were using it as a shield for doing what they wanted to do. And they thought to say they were prisoners of war was sufficient to excuse them for anything.
Mm.